Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive into ideas that truly reshape our world. Today, we're taking on, well, a really foundational thinker of the 20th century, Jacques Derrida, and specifically his truly paradigm-shifting book of grammatology. Get ready for some intellectual gymnastics.
You're absolutely right to call it paradigm-shifting. This isn't just a book. It's more like an intellectual earthquake.
Right.
It really challenges everything we thought we knew about language, how we write, and, I mean, what meaning even is.
Wow.
We've gathered comprehensive summaries and key excerpts to sort of guide you through its revolutionary insights.
Okay, so our mission today is to explore this groundbreaking work. We want to give you a clear path, a shortcut, really, to understanding one of the most influential and, let's be honest, often quite challenging books in the humanities.
Definitely challenging, but deeply rewarding.
Yeah, because Derrida isn't just asking, you know, what do we mean? He's digging way deeper into how meaning is even constructed in the first place.
Exactly. And in doing that, he forces us, really, to reevaluate the very nature of language communication, even our perception of reality itself. It's a journey that reveals these often hidden structures beneath our everyday interactions.
So who was this intellectual powerhouse, Jacques Derrida? I mean, his name alone is synonymous with intense philosophical debate.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jacques Derrida, born in Algeria in 1930, passed away in 2004. He was an Algerian-French philosopher who profoundly redefined critical thought.
Okay.
And his background, it's actually key to understanding his unique perspective.
How so?
Well, imagine experiencing life as both an insider and an outsider to French intellectual culture. He was Jewish-Algerian, living and working in Paris.
Ah, okay. That kind of dual perspective.
Precisely. And this unique positioning gave him a really distinctive lens. He could look at questions of identity, belonging, how language shapes our sense of self and place, from a slightly different angle.
And he was trilingual too, wasn't he? Arabic, French, and German.
That's right.
That must have given him an incredible, almost intuitive feel for how different languages construct reality differently.
Exactly. That trilingual education profoundly influenced his philosophical development. It highlighted for him the often arbitrary nature of linguistic and cultural boundaries, things that, you know, many monolingual thinkers might just take for granted.
Right. Makes sense.
He studied at the prestigious École Normale Supérieure in Paris, engaged deeply with thinkers like Husserl and Sartre. But he really forged his own path. He became the principal architect of deconstruction.
The big one.
The big one. A critical method for reading texts that we'll definitely dive into today.
And 1967 was a huge year for him, right? Grammatology came out then.
Monumental. That book, along with two other seminal works, all published in 67, it instantly established him as a leading figure in what we now call post-structuralism. His deep engagement with philosophy, linguistics, literary theory, it made him uniquely positioned to question the very bedrock, the fundamental categories of Western thought.
Okay, so with that picture of Derrida, let's dive into the core earthquake of this book.
Mm-hmm.
What's the truly radical idea that makes of grammatology still shake things up today?
Okay, imagine a world where we've sort of unconsciously believed that the spoken word is always more real, more authentic, more directly connected to truth than anything written down.
Yeah, it feels familiar, like a face-to-face conversation is somehow pure.
Exactly. Derrida calls this deep, often hidden bias logocentrism.
Logocentrism, okay.
And his revolutionary insight, he shows this isn't just like a preference, it's a fundamental misunderstanding that kind of unravels much of Western thought.
Wow.
For millennia, speech to logos has been seen as primary, you know, the direct channel to consciousness and truth. Mm-hmm. While writing, well, writing gets relegated to this secondary derivative status, just a mere copy.
So we've always thought of writing as just a way to record what we say. Not something fundamental in itself, like a secondhand version of thought, maybe a poor imitation.
Precisely. Derrida's primary thesis is that this hierarchy isn't just wrong. It fundamentally misunderstands language itself. And he doesn't just, you know, flip the hierarchy and say writing is better.
Okay.
No, instead, he aims to deconstruct this opposition. He wants to show that the very characteristics we negatively attribute to writing, things like absence, difference, mediation.
Like the fact the writer isn't there or it can be interpreted differently.
Exactly those things. He argues they're actually essential conditions for any form of language, including speech.
Wait, so the very things we often criticize writing for, its distance, its ambiguity, Derrida argues are actually foundational to all language, even the spoken word.
Yes.
That turns everything completely on its head.
It absolutely does. And, you know, why this bias for speech? Derrida says it springs from what he calls the metaphysics of presence.
Metaphysics of presence. Okay, what's that?
It's our deep, almost spiritual desire for pure, unmediated truth. We want to believe meaning is right here, right now.
Ah, like we want the real thing directly.
Yes, fully present, untouched by anything else. Speech seems to offer that immediacy, that presence, while writing feels like a detour, maybe an unnecessary middleman.
So if we always want this immediate, pure truth, how does Derrida challenge that very idea of stable, present meaning? Because it sounds like what he's doing.
He does it with his most famous concept, difference.
Difference. Okay, I've heard this term. It looks like difference, but with an A.
Exactly. And it's a unique spelling he created, playing on two French words, one meaning to differ and the other meaning to defer or delay.
Okay, differ and defer.
Right. Imagine trying to pin down the exact meaning of a word. You look it up, right?
Yeah.
Then you look at the words in that definition.
Yeah.
And then the words in those definitions.
Right. It keeps going, like falling down a rabbit hole.
Precisely. Meaning, Derrida says, is never fully present in one place. It's always differing from other words. It is what it is because it's not something else. And it's always deferred, pushed down the chain, relying on future contexts or other signs.
So it's never just there.
Never just there. It's a constant, almost playful instability. Not a fixed point. Meaning, he argues, is less like a solid rock and more like, I don't know, shifting sand.
Okay.
Constantly moving, always multiple, playing with endless differences. It's never truly fixed, always in motion.
Now, how does Derrida convince us of something so, well, counterintuitive? He doesn't just state it, right? He takes us on this brilliant, almost forensic tour through Western thought.
He does. It's quite the journey. He begins by announcing what he calls the end of the book and the beginning of writing.
End of the book. What does that mean? Is he anti-book?
Huh. No, not literally the end of physical books. He means the end of a certain idea of the book. The idea that knowledge can be linear, stable, contained, totalizing. Like a book holding all the truth.
Okay. The end of that kind of authority.
Right. And with it comes the beginning of writing. A new understanding of textuality. Seeing texts as open, interconnected, dynamic.
Okay.
And then he introduces arch writing, or archiequature. This is crucial. Derrida doesn't just say writing is important. He kind of blows up our usual idea of writing.
How so?
He says there's this deeper, more fundamental pattern of differences and gaps. This structure of spacing and deferral that exists before any actual speech or writing happens.
Before?
Before and beneath. He calls it arch writing. It's like the silent scaffolding, the underlying condition that makes any meaning possible, whether spoken or written.
So writing isn't just ink on paper or pixels on a screen. It's a deep-seated structure of how we make sense of anything. Wow, that's a huge reframing.
It is. It's fundamental difference and deferral. Then he dives into a critical engagement with Ferdinand de Saussure.
The founder of modern linguistics.
The very one. Derrida actually praises Saussure for his groundbreaking insights. You know, language is a system of differences, how a word gets its meaning, not from some inherent quality, but from its difference from other words. Cat means cat because it's not dog or mat.
Right. I remember that from linguistics, the arbitrary sign.
Exactly. But Derrida sharply critiques Saussure's explicit phonocentrism.
Phonocentrism, the focus on sound, on speech.
Yes. Saussure insisted that linguistics was the science of the spoken word and that writing was just a secondary, even perverse system for representing speech.
So Saussure, the architect of modern linguistics, argued speech was primary. But Derrida, does he use Saussure's own logic against him?
He does, brilliantly. He shows that the very principles Saussure discovered for speech, things like arbitrariness and difference, are actually defining characteristics of writing.
Ah.
Which implies that speech itself, at a fundamental level, functions like this arch writing. It relies on difference and absence, just like writing does.
That's clever. Turning the tables using the opponent's own tools.
Precisely. Then, in maybe the most famous part of the book, Derrida takes a philosophical scalpel to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's writings. Especially his essay on the origin of languages.
Rousseau, the Enlightenment thinker, big on nature and feeling.
That's him. And Rousseau passionately championed speech and nature over writing and culture. He saw writing as a dangerous supplement.
A dangerous supplement? What does he mean by that?
He saw it as an external, artificial addition. something that corrupts an original pure thought or feeling, which was supposed to be whole and present in speech.
So Rousseau thought writing was something tacked on, something unnecessary if the original thought or speech was perfect, almost like a contaminant.
That's a good way to put it. A contaminant, or something that signals a fall from grace, a loss of natural presence. But Derrida skillfully reveals Rousseau's blind spot here.
Okay.
He demonstrates that this very supplement writing, in Rousseau's case, but the concept is broader, is actually necessary from the very start.
Necessary.
Because it doesn't just add to an already complete origin. It actually fills an inherent lack in that supposed origin. It proves the pure origin was never truly pure or complete to begin with.
Wow. So the supplement isn't just adding, it's also replacing or making up for something missing.
Exactly. It highlights a fundamental incompleteness in the thing it supplements.
The idea that what we think is an extra actually reveals an absence in the original that is genuinely mind-expanding. It's like finding a patch on a garment and realizing the garment must have always been torn or at least vulnerable.
That's a great analogy, yes. And he extends this analysis further with the violence of the letter. Here he looks at the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss.
Lévi-Strauss, okay. Structural anthropology.
Right. Specifically, Lévi-Strauss's account of the Nambiquara people in Brazil, a non-literate group. Lévi-Strauss describes the introduction of writing to this tribe as essentially an act of violence, a tool of power and social division.
Okay, that seems plausible. Writing can be used for control.
Derrida agrees that writing is intrinsically linked to power. He doesn't dispute that. But he critiques Lévi-Strauss's sort of Rousseauian nostalgia, this idea of a pure, innocent, pre-literate state.
The noble savage idea.
Kind of. Derrida argues that hierarchy, difference, power structures, forms of social writing like rules, classifications, kinship systems, these were already present in Nambiquara society before phonetic writing arrived.
So writing didn't introduce violence or hierarchy into paradise?
No. According to Derrida, the arrival of phonetic writing simply reconfigured existing structures of power and difference. It didn't invent them in a peaceful, unwritten world. It was a new layer, a powerful one, but building on something already there.
All right, so that's a lot of dense philosophy. We've gone through logocentrism, difference, arch writing, critiques of Saussure, Rousseau, Lévi-Strauss. But here's the crucial question. What does this mind-bending journey really mean for us, for you listening? How can we use these insights in our own world?
That's the key question, isn't it? Let's distill some core takeaways. First, the critique of phonocentrism. This isn't just some dusty academic debate. It challenges how we value different forms of communication every day.
How so? Give us an example.
Think about how we often prioritize direct spoken communication, a face-to-face meeting, a phone call. We often feel it's more authentic or real than, say, an email or a text message.
Yeah, definitely. A text can feel cold or easily misunderstood.
Right. But Derrida makes us question why we feel that way. Is that bias really justified? He shows that speech itself depends on structural features we usually attribute only to writing, like repeatability, the possibility of being understood even when the speaker isn't present.
Okay. So speech isn't as purely present as we think. That's fascinating. It really makes you think about authenticity in communication, especially now with so much digital interaction. Where does authentic meaning truly reside?
Exactly. It pushes us to reconsider. Secondly, there's difference and the play of meaning. This concept teaches us that meaning is never totally fixed or fully present. It's always being displaced, delayed. It arises from this complex network of differences.
So no single final meaning.
Pretty much. No text, no utterance has one single determinate meaning locked inside it. Think about interpreting a really complex email or trying to understand a nuanced conversation you had.
Yeah.
Meaning often emerges in the back and forth, right? In the gaps, the connections, the context.
Yeah.
Not usually in one single isolated phrase.
So the meaning isn't just there waiting to be found. It's something that's constantly being made and remade in the act of interpretation, like a dance rather than a solid object you can just grab.
That's a wonderful way to put it. A dance. Precisely. And that leads nicely to the third takeaway. The logic of supplementarity.
Right. The idea that the extra thing isn't really extra.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What appears to be a secondary addition, a supplement, often reveals a fundamental lack or gap in the original thing, its supplements, which means the supplement was actually necessary from the start in a way.
Can you give a more everyday example of that?
Sure. Think about making plans.
Yeah.
You have your main plan, plan A. Then you make a backup plan, plan B, just in case.
Okay.
We think a plan B is just an extra, a supplement. But its very existence, the need to even think about a plan B, acknowledges the inherent possibility that plan A might fail, that it's incomplete or vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The supplement points to something missing or potentially missing in the original.
That's a crucial distinction, and one we so often overlook, I think. We think we're just adding a backup, but we're actually admitting the original wasn't perfect or guaranteed to begin with.
Exactly. And finally, related to all this, we have the instability of meaning. This is a big one. It teaches us that meaning isn't stable, it's not fixed, it's not guaranteed by what the author or speaker intended. It's constantly in flux, produced by the complex, context-dependent play of language, of difference. Think about this. Have you ever reread an old book or maybe listened to a song from your past?
Yeah, sure.
And found entirely new layers of meaning in it, things you never saw or felt before?
Absolutely. All the time.
Well, the text or the song didn't change, did it?
No.
But you did. Your context, your experiences, your understanding, that changed. And so the meaning changed too. That's difference at work over time.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Beyond these core shifts in thinking, Derrida left us with some truly iconic, almost cryptic phrases, lines that really encapsulate his revolution. Let's maybe dig into a few of those notable ideas.
Definitely. One of his most famous and probably most misunderstood statements is, there is nothing outside the text. Il n'y a pas d'or text.
Right. I've heard that one. It sounds like he's saying reality doesn't exist, only words.
And that's the common misunderstanding.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the physical world doesn't exist. Of course it does. What it means is that we have no access to reality or history or even our own consciousness, except through the mediating structures of signification.
Signification, like language, symbols.
Exactly. Through text, in the broadest possible sense.
Yeah.
Language, culture, social codes, systems of meaning. There is no pure, unmediated presence, no direct grasp of reality outside of this interpretive framework that language and culture provide.
Okay. So our perception of reality is always filtered, always mediated by, well, by textuality in his broad sense. That really makes you think about how we construct our world. My brain is officially doing philosophical gymnastics right now.
It's quite the workout.
Mm.
Another powerful insight is captured in his explanation of the supplement. The supplement supplements. It adds only to replace. It intervenes or insinuates itself in the place of.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
It highlights that paradoxical double function of the supplement we talked about. It seems to just add something extra. But in adding, it also substitutes, it takes the place of something, revealing an inherent lack or gap in the original thing it was meant to complete or enhance. It shows us that what we often think is just an extra was actually fundamentally needed because the original wasn't self-sufficient.
Right, filling a gap that was already there.
Yes. And finally, the concept that really underpins so much of this. Difference is what makes possible the presentation of the being present.
Okay, so difference makes presence possible. That sounds contradictory.
It sounds it, but think about it. Difference, this play of difference and deferral, isn't simply the opposite of presence. Derrida argues it's actually the very condition that allows anything to appear as present or meaningful at all. Well, for something to be perceived, for it to stand out as present, it needs to differ from something else, right? And it needs to persist, even momentarily, deferring its disappearance. Without that play of differences and deferrals, nothing could emerge, nothing could be identified or acquire meaning. Difference is the engine of signification itself.
Wow, okay. This might sound incredibly abstract to some listeners, but Derrida's ideas, as you've shown, have surprisingly practical implications. For your world listening right now, how can we actually use this knowledge?
Great question. For one, it's invaluable for developing critical thinking. Seriously. Deconstruction is a powerful tool.
How so?
It helps you question those seemingly natural binaries and hierarchies we encounter constantly. Think about reason versus emotion. Nature versus culture, original versus copy, male versus female.
Things we often just accept.
Right. Deconstruction encourages you to look at what's being marginalized or suppressed in those pairings,
mm-hmm.
to ask why one side is valued over the other. You can apply this to a news report, a political speech, advertising, even legal documents. It empowers you to see beyond the surface, to find the hidden assumptions.
And I can see how this is hugely relevant in our current age of media and digital culture.
Well, absolutely. Derrida's focus on writing, on textuality, is more relevant than ever. Think about it. Social media, email, texting. These are all forms of writing that profoundly shape our social reality now.
Mm-hmm.
His ideas help us analyze how these technologies mediate our identity, our relationships, our very sense of authenticity. Is a perfectly curated Instagram feed more authentic than a messy, unfiltered moment? Derrida gives us a framework to question those assumptions.
That's very true. It also sounds like it has profound implications for things like legal and political interpretation.
Indeed. Deconstruction has significantly impacted legal studies, particularly by challenging the idea of a fixed original intent in law.
Like trying to figure out exactly what the founders meant hundreds of years ago.
Exactly. Derrida's work suggests that texts, like laws or constitutions, are always open to reinterpretation as contexts change. Meaning, isn't locked in the past. This makes law a dynamic, contested field, not just a static set of rules waiting to be applied.
And what about something really personal, like rethinking personal identity? Can Derrida help there?
I think so. Many of us search for a stable, true self, right? Mm-hmm. An authentic core. Derrida's ideas might suggest our identity is more like a text.
Like a text.
Yeah. Constantly being written and rewritten. Through our words, our actions, our relationships, the culture we inhabit, maybe there's no single, fixed, authentic self hiding outside this complex web of signs and interactions. Identity becomes more of a process, a continual writing, rather than a static thing.
That's a less rigid way to think about ourselves. Maybe less pressure, too.
Could be. And finally, it definitely changes how we can appreciate ambiguity in art and literature. Instead of always searching for the one true meaning of a poem, or a novel, or a film, you know, what did the author really mean? Deconstruction allows us to embrace the richness, to appreciate the ambiguity, the contradictions, the multiple layers. It validates different, even conflicting interpretations. It makes art more interesting, not less.
What a truly transformative deep dive. It feels like we've rewired our understanding of meaning itself. It's clear that Derrida wasn't just, you know, playing with words. He was fundamentally changing how we think about thinking.
You're absolutely right. And I think the most valuable lesson, maybe, is a fundamental shift in perspective. Away from constantly seeking stable origins or absolute final truths.
Yeah.
And towards understanding our world, ourselves, our communication as this complex, endlessly interpretable text. It's humbling, but it's also quite liberating, I find.
So the next time you write an email or read an article or even just, you know, consider how you define yourself, remember these powerful, often hidden forces, difference, arch writing. They're shaping everything. What will you deconstruct in your own life today?
It encourages a more humble, I think, and reflexive approach to interpretation, one that remains open. Open to surprise, open to contradiction, and open to ongoing transformation. It reminds us that knowledge isn't really about finding the final answers, maybe, but about engaging in this endless, rich process of questioning and reinterpretation.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.